Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, as usual. And, Jim, it was just a few days ago that we were talking about a CNN poll that showed 52% of Americans opposing the Iran deal, 44% approving. We were happy that the opposition was better than the approval, but we were wondering whether that kind of closeness of the numbers was really going to put any pressure on lawmakers. Well, the more time goes on, the more people don't like it. There's a new Quinnipiac poll out showing that Americans really don't like this now. Do you support or oppose the nuclear deal with Iran? 28% support, 57% oppose. Do you think the nuclear deal with Iran would make the world safer or less safe? Safer, 30%. Less safe, 58%. And when you look at some of the other questions on this poll about making income more equal and immigration, the more liberal positions have a much higher percentage. So it's not like they just went to the Republican National Committee or a conservative grassroots organization to do this. Even with interviewing people who have a pretty liberal position on some other issues, they hate this deal. That's great news.
It is. There are a couple of things that kind of jump out about that. One is that one key goal for the deal skeptic side or the deal opposition side, Obama has gone forth and made his best case for the deal, and he has failed. The public does not believe it. They do not believe that they are safer because of it. They do not trust the Iranians. They do not believe the deal is verifiable. They believe the deal will make America less safe. That's pretty, and it's a pretty solid majority. I think really intriguing is about 30 to 40% of Democrats are really skeptical at best of this deal and in fact oppose it, which I think really points to this. And if, you know, I expect that this deal is going to go through, you will not get the two-thirds majorities needed in the House and Senate to block the deal, thanks to the Corker arrangement. But you look at numbers like this, and it doesn't seem so impossible. Apparently, there are reports out this morning from Politico that Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York, and seen as a very key indicator of this, the future leader of the Democrats in the Senate, is leaning no. I'll believe it when I see it. I can't help but suspect there's a little bit of contrived drama going on here. Another key House Democrat, Adam Schiff, said he was signing on. One of two things will happen. Either the deal will get rejected, which is very good news, or the deal will be, will go through despite pretty overwhelming opposition. And that has certain, uses for folks on the right as well. Even though it would be much better to actually stop the deal.
Absolutely. Well, the president wants this to be basically the foreign policy version of Obamacare. He's basically got the same public approval numbers on both issues. Unfortunately, Obamacare got through, and it looks like, as you mentioned, given the way that the Republicans basically handed to the president a logistical victory here, that's probably going to happen too. But if these numbers keep going into the tank, some of these Democrats might actually start feeling some pressure. It's still 52-32 Democrats in favor of this. So unless they start to feel maybe a little more pressure from their own people, it's hard to see that some of these dyed-in-the-wool liberals are going to move to the no column, especially in large enough numbers. But as long as we're talking about terrible Obama administration ideas, let's move to the bad martini now. And the president today will be announcing an even tougher version of his power plant carbon emissions rule. Jim, this is according to Yahoo News. The Obama administration estimates the emissions limits will cost $8.4 billion annually by 2030. The final version imposes stricter carbon dioxide limits on states than was previously expected, a 32% cut by 2030 compared to 2005 levels. The White House said Obama's proposed version last year called for a 30% cut. You've already got the energy industry ready to take this to court. You've got states led by Republican governors with Republican majorities in the legislature saying we're just not going to comply with this because it's obviously going to cripple manufacturing, jack up power rates, and all sorts of other things. And just from talking about this in the past year, Jim, I remember talking to folks saying the technology doesn't even exist yet in some of these plants to actually bring the emissions into line. So he's once again basically doing it by edict because he knows he can't do it through Congress.
Yeah, another example of a line that should have gotten more attention back in 2007, 2008. I believe it was late in the 2008 campaign. Biden is at a rally, and he says, no coal plants here in America. If you live in coal country, if your job depends on the coal industry, if your electricity rates depend on the coal industry, and you voted for Barack Obama and Joe Biden, I have no sympathy for you. It was pretty clear what these guys felt from the very beginning. Now, the other thing is kind of intriguing about the EPA's approach to this. As you pointed out, this isn't being done through legislation. This is not being done through any expression or support through the legislative process. The EPA has just decided to go forward with this. as they've done in several other, you know, arenas of environmental regulation. On the cruise, Mary Catherine Hamm was describing seeing the new EPA administrator on the Bill Maher show. This is the non-Lisa Jackson / Richard Widzer email EPA administrator. Right. As we all know, Lisa Jackson is a multiple personality, and that's why she uses the Richard Widzer email account, just like Hillary using a private email account for government business. Anyway, but this EPA administrator said that they had enacted new rules and power plants were making the changes. And at one point, Bill Maher says, but aren't you guys getting fought for that in court? And the EPA administrator said, yes, we are, but that's okay, because even if it gets rejected, the power plants have already made the changes. And there's a certain cynicism to that. There's a certain cutthroat ruthlessness to that, that you realize you don't have the authority to make the change, or that you're eventually going to lose the legal challenge to this, but you go forward with it anyway because you can force that. By the way, this is a circumstance in which I think, you know, power plants would be perfectly fine to say, look, we don't, you know, we don't think you have the authority to do this. We don't think we think you're overstretching your bounds. This is the regulatory equivalent of an unlawful order, and we're not under any obligations to obey it, and we're going to engage in civil disobedience. And we'll take you to court because we don't think you have the authority to do this. And I think fairly obviously, the EPA is not supposed to have these far-reaching powers to completely rewrite the entire energy industry, particularly in opposition from Congress and the legislative will. Hopefully we'll see that fight and, you know, shake out that way. But in the interim, the EPA is going to keep doing this, and it's going to be up to the energy industry. Do they live with it, or do they attempt to defy it and take their chances through the legal challenges?
Jim, just thinking about our two martinis so far and several other issues as it relates to the Obama administration, whether it's the Iran deal, whether it's power regulations going 15 years into the future here, or healthcare, or economic policy. It seems like a lot of this, obviously, that we expect to crash on the rocks and crash hard is going to happen perhaps many years after he leaves office. Do you think he's actually going to pay the price for that in history, or do you think it's just going to fall on the shoulders of whoever's in office then?
When the Avengers trailer came out and they used the line, there are no strings on me, that really does seem to represent the Obama philosophy in this last term. And I think probably, you know, one of the things you and I have discussed in recent weeks is the mood of gloom amongst conservatives. And I think a big part of it is the fact that they thought they were doing something with the 2014 midterms. And I don't think we've ever seen a president that has ever so thoroughly rejected his own concept of being a lame duck by saying, no. The best part is the last 2 years, because I can't get thrown out of office and my party can't get thrown out of Congress, and I just flat out don't care what anybody thinks of me. If everybody opposes the Iran deal, it doesn't matter. I'm going right ahead with it. If Obamacare is unpopular, never mind. I'm still going to veto any attempt to reform it. We have a runaway president right now, a guy who does not really care how unpopular things are because he knows that he's right. And one, you don't usually have a president who is this openly in opposition to what popular opinion is. And then in that case, second case, is one who's so blasé about ignoring popular will on sort of this. We're kind of going into uncharted territory here. And I think that there's that atmosphere of, if not panic, deep-rooted anxiety amongst most conservatives that the Constitution itself and the very concepts of our country are under attack.
On to the crazy martini now. And of course, Thursday night is the first major debate of the 2016 presidential cycle. As we all know, the top 10 in this mix of national polls that Fox News is watching will make the main debate stage at 9 p.m. Eastern. The other seven will be on at 5 o'clock on Fox. And so use whatever metaphor you want to there. Undercard, kids table. Eventually it's going to happen. And tomorrow we're going to find out from Fox who makes which debate. Right now, we're getting an interesting feedback from the McClatchy-Marist poll, which basically wants no part of this process, Jim. This is according to the Washington Examiner. The McClatchy-Marist poll has temporarily suspended its survey of primary voters because of, quote, concern that public polls are being misused to decide who will be in and who will be excluded from the first nationally televised debate of GOP presidential candidate. The director of the Marist Institute, Lee Mieringoff, says it's a problem when it's shaping who gets to sit at the table. It's a bad use of polls. It asks public polls to have a precision that ignores the margin of error. There's a big distinction made where there's no statistical difference. And obviously the difference between 10 and 11, if you look at some of these polls, is very, very thin. So I think, Jim, first of all, pollsters are a little bit leery being part of the process and deciding who gets to do what. But then obviously the margin of error is a big issue too. I mean, if there's a 2 or 3 point margin of error, who really ought to be there could be very different.
As much as you sympathize with the networks of saying, look, we don't have a stage with 17 spots on it. If you think candidates didn't get enough time last cycle, imagine how little time they'll get in a 2-hour debate with 17 candidates participating. I understand networks are in a tough spot. Having said that, I think we're going to look back on this and say, okay, this system is not going to work particularly well. And I'm not just saying that because some of my favorites like Carly Fiorina and Bobby Jindal and perhaps Rick Perry aren't going to be up on the top tier debate. I think part of the problem is, one, you're using national polls. So if you're a candidate who spent a lot of time focusing on Iowa, a lot of time focusing on New Hampshire, well, all of a sudden that doesn't matter anymore. All of a sudden it depends on how are you doing nationally. And some of these candidates have been around for a really long time. Some of these candidates have not. Carly Fiorina is relatively a new figure on the national stage. And for a candidate like that, or Jindal, or you know, I suppose you could say the governors who have rolled out of retirement like Jim Gilmore and George Pataki, they haven't had a chance to be up on the national stage. So, you know, and how do you get to become more popular? Well, you get your chance on the national stage. So it's kind of a chicken and the egg sort of thing. Like, how do you build up your national name ID if you can't get up on the debate? And because you don't get up on the debate, you don't get the chance to build up your national name ID. So I kind of have a certain amount of respect for Marist saying, look, we're not going to be a part of this. The person who's in 11th place in our poll might actually be in 10th place. At that point, everybody's down at 3, 4, 5%. It's all about the same. And the idea of keeping somebody off, because in the aggregate polls that Fox News is using, it just seems like, you know, Rick Santorum, another guy who might not be on the stage, is limiting. It's a very arbitrary standard. Now, yes, everybody gets to be at the kiddie table debate beforehand. Everybody will get a chance. I'll be watching both of them. Certainly, if there's a great moment in that first debate, that, you know, any great spark of discussion or conflict or good one-liner, that's all going to end up on YouTube. That's how a lot of people are going to end up watching this, is the coverage afterwards. So there's a chance for all these candidates to break out, but I think that a lot of people are going to say, you know what, you should have just split the crowd 8 and 8 or 8 and 9 and do it randomly, and then, you know, don't have the people who are at 1 or 2% right now dismissed as fringe and ridiculous also-ran candidates. Give them their chance to debut, and if they flop, they flop. But otherwise, you turn into a situation in which name ID begets more name ID, and time on a debate stage means, you know, results in more time on a debate stage. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Good point. And if you're in the early debate, if you're not in the top 10, do you really spend your time, if you're Jindal or Fiorina, going after some of the other seven who are at 2.5%? Or does this become a bash session on those who are going to be debating later in the top 10?
In your face, Pataki, okay? Eat it, Gilmore, you know. At some point, if it appears at this point, it looks like Rick Perry is the guy who's going to be at number 11 and looked like he was going to be on the top stage a few weeks ago. And it looks like Kasich has picked up a little bit, or Christie's somewhere in that, you know, 9th or 10th spot. If he's there, I suppose I would not begrudge Rick Perry. Somebody, I can't believe I'm here with the little kids. It probably would be seen as bad taste or something like that. The other thing is, you could probably, if you're anti-Trump, and Rick Perry certainly has ripped into Trump a bunch of times, you could really tear into him in that first debate, knowing he's not on the stage, and just see if anybody else joins.
Could be very interesting to see how the early debate perhaps influences how the second debate goes. But time will tell. Jim, good start to the week. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and tune in again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.